For a discussion of the week's news, I'm joined by Charlie Pierce, who's begun the grueling road trip that will take him to various basketball venues over the next few weeks. Hello, Charlie.
Well, it's not Lewis and Clark. I have room service and stuff.
Yeah, probably motorized vehicles as well. The NCAA men's basketball tournament, which will begin on Tuesday, will see an estimated 40 million people filling out brackets with a projected $2 billion wagered in pools. So, would it be an exaggeration to say that the business of college basketball is booming?
Well, both the overground and underground economies certainly are. This is once again one of the either unintended consequences or unintended benefits of the internet has made this kind of gambling a lot easier. In a lot of ways, the NCAA Division I men's basketball tournament is what this country has for a World Cup.
By one estimation, men's NCAA basketball teams generated $1.6 billion in revenue last year. And according to a publication called Nerd Wallet, if we were to apply the NBA's revenue-sharing model, the average player at a top 25 school would be worth nearly $488,000. That sound about right to you?
It sounds about right to me. And of course, this is the great issue on which the existing paradigm of college sports is tottering right on the brink of falling down and breaking into a zillion pieces. The inequity has grown so obviously grotesque that it's not supportable.
Before we move on from basketball, Charlie, would you like to offer only a game's congratulations to a team that will enter the dance undefeated?
This will be the third time since 1976 that this has happened. I think Kentucky has a better shot at actually ending the season without a loss than Vegas did in 1991.
Yeah, but that's the wrong team. I'm thinking about
the Princeton women.
Yeah.
I hope Princeton can make a run because it would be a great, great story. But I'm still seeing, you know, Connecticut and Duke and North Carolina and Notre Dame and the rest of the A-list out there. So, yes, I would hope that Princeton would be able to make a serious run because, as I said, it would be a glorious story.
Well, it would be. And if they do manage to even win a game, they would be the first Ivy League women's team to win a tournament game since Harvard upset number one Stanford in 1998.
Yeah, this would be also a good thing. I'm wondering if alum Bill Bradley, who was on the last Princeton team to make the Final Four, will be there.
After a string of accusations of match-fixing in the lower ranks of pro tennis, Slate this week tried to get a handle on what's going on. Their experts suggested that multiple matches a week involving players making as little as $500 per tournament were being influenced by gamblers. I'm not surprised to learn that this is going on in places like Ukraine, but matches in Dallas seem to be suspect as well. Are you shocked?
I am absolutely shocked. Of course, there's a long and storied history of this kind of thing and this kind of barely concealed corruption. It goes back to the days when they were trying to maintain the amateur model in tennis, and I suspect it's been going on sub rosa ever since.
Gamblers are apparently using Facebook messages to contact tennis players who might be financially vulnerable, so just another way in which social media is ruining the world.
What are they doing? Tracking whether among these people's likes are, you know, two for one night at Olive Garden or something? Is there a like button for bribes?
This seems to me consistent with fixes in other sports. I mean, the Kentucky Derby is not as likely to be rigged as, oh, say, a midweek $1,500 claimer at Humpty Dumpty Downs in East Nowhere, right?
I think that's the case. I mean, I don't know how people finally tumble to this unless somebody was dissatisfied with their payout. I think this is exactly the kind of thing that happens where people aren't watching on ESPN.
Speaking of those who would skirt the regulations in one way or another, Brent Sass, an accomplished sled dog racer, has been disqualified at the Iditarod, but he wants his fans to know, quote, "I was not cheating in any way, shape, or form. I was just stupid." How did his stupidity manifest itself?
The theme of this week's segment is obviously the baleful influence of modern technology on competitive sports. This guy was using his iPad Touch.
Yeah, and he didn't even know it was against the rules, you know.
What advantage does he get?
Oh, GPS, find the shortcuts.
Well, that's just cheating itself, isn't it? I mean, if you find a shortcut in the Iditarod.
Chicago White Sox broadcaster Ken Harrelson said this week that he thinks it might be the Cubs and the White Sox in the World Series this time around. This is just exactly the sort of dream for which spring training was created, right?
Obviously, he has a vested interest in saying that about the White Sox, but the Cubs are expected to, you know, with the arrival of Joe Maddon and apparently a loaded farm system, the Cubs are, you know, expected, you know, to start making a move now under Theo Epstein.
And finally, Charlie, there have been complaints about unruly spectators at golf tournaments recently, but controversy erupted this week over a well-behaved but unwelcome fan at a women's tournament at Mayaca Pines Golf Club in Englewood, Florida. You want to describe that visitor for us?
A big old par five alligator, Bill. This was a Godzilla gator. I can't drive the ball the length of this alligator. I really can't. This thing is huge.
It looks like he crawled out of the prehistoric past, doesn't he?
We have ground rules and we have winter rules, and now we have large carnivore rules in golf. My score could really drop, by the way.
You can find the sports writing of Charlie Pierce at Grantland. Charlie, thanks very much.
Thanks, Bill.